Club. Driving. No purchase necessary.
You're listening to Radio Free Urbanism.
Welcome back to Radio Free Urbanism, folks. It's a podcast about urbanism and stuff. I am one of your hosts. My name is Alex Williams, and I am joined today by two greatest co-hosts anybody has ever had in the history of podcasting ever. We're going to start
people are
with...
Saying this.
Many people are saying this. Ethan, that was the funniest joke you made when Taylor was like, don't listen to Ethan. That's what I'm getting from this. And then you were like, many people are saying this, folks. Funniest joke I have ever heard. I've laughed about it again and again. Anyways, we've got Ethan Myers here. Say hi, Ethan.
Welcome back, you beautiful people. And if you're just joining for the first time, hello and welcome to the show.
Awesome. And of course, we've also got Nick Laporte.
Hello. I'm glad to be in this seat again. It's nice and cozy. I don't have to speak as much. So that's good. Good for everybody's ears, maybe?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Probably.
That's why I'm such a good co-host, is by not talking.
It's true. Actually, Ethan and I actually give 90% of the proceeds to Nick so that he will talk less than us.
This is true. You can fact check this. This is 100% true.
Yeah, we were just discussing the Patreon, how we might add an extra tier, the God tier. And if you pay us $5,000 a month, we will not have the podcast. Each month we have $5,000 from that lender or Patreon member, no podcast. So,
but speaking about that, if it isn't as affordable to pay $5,000 a month, we do have other tiers that do provide you with other benefits for the show. So if you folks want to join our Patreon, see the show early, be in the live chat for the show, get access to our Discord, it's only going to cost you $1 American a month.
Wow, which is like 30 Canadian dollars. So start saving your pennies, folks. We've already got Ethan here in the, or Austin here in the live chat with us. And we're ready to have a pretty good time, at least a decently good time on today's episode today, which is happening on today. Nick, you've got something to start us off with.
No, let's
today.
Start with Ethan. Ethan could go first.
Okay, Ethan's going first.
Yeah, it's just a quick update. I'm going to be in Chicago next week, so I won't be on the show. But don't worry, I will be back in 2 weeks. So, you know, if you can't handle the show's main antagonist being gone for a week, then it's okay. I'll be back. No need to worry.
We might be having a bottle episode next week. Fewer, lower cast, cheaper sets, you know, that sort of thing. I don't know why I feel like this is the first time I'm hearing about this. I'm going to miss you, Ethan. But if you guys want, we've got Nick next. I'm directionless.
Our host is directionless.
Well, okay. Speaking about directionless, you're going to get some Jekyll and Hyde from me this episode here for different reasons, but I'm going to start off with a Wugmug, which is something that grinds my gears. What does Wugmug stand for? What grinds my gears?
Yeah.
What? Yeah.
No.
Something. It's a Wugmug, but I'm going to start positive, okay? I at least have to get that in there before we get to the thing I need to complain about. And this is the Seymour Valley Trailway. And this is something that I've been meaning to go check out in the North Shore of Vancouver for a very long time. And it's a paved path that's for cyclists and pedestrians to go up into the mountains on the North Shore between Seymour Mountain and Grouse Mountain. And it ends up at a dam, which I think there's photos here I'm posting here on YouTube you can see right now. And it was beautiful. It's amazing. It's about 12 kilometers from start to finish. So a round trip, it's about 24 kilometers if you go from the trailhead all the way to the dam and back, which is a great, nice bike ride. But my wife and I took this ride from our place in Vancouver. So we had to go east down Vancouver, head over the Second Narrows, and then through North Vancouver up to the trailhead. So we had a nice long ride, and we came across something on our way back that, honestly, I have to say, I don't think I've ever... maybe never been as scared as I was in my entire life as I was and this thing that happened. So there's this road in North Vancouver. We were heading back to the city center of North Vancouver, and there's a road called Low Level Road. And we looked on the map as we're heading back, and it showed that there was actually a bike lane or some kind of some bike infrastructure was there. That was the point. When you look on Google Maps, there's a green line. Like, okay, we'll go that way to get to downtown North Vancouver to hit the C bus. So we start going, and I look at the beginning of this road, and I'm like, oh, it doesn't look great. So we start heading down this road, and let me paint a picture for you. So low-level road, if you're looking down it, you have a retaining wall, a very tall retaining wall, and on the left side is just these towers. Basically, they look like grain towers. I don't know if they have sulfur in them or whatever substances they keep in there. And it's a two-lane road with, air quotes, bike lanes on both sides. It's just bike gutters like you would normally have. So what happened is we were just riding down this road like you do, and it was fine. It was fine. It's supposed to be a 50/60 kilometer per hour road. Obviously, people go faster than that. And it was unpleasant. It was just unpleasant. It wasn't fun. It's like you normally have on these types of roads. For people like me and my wife, we're the, I think it's like strong, confident or whatever cyclist level of stress. We're not the fearless types, but we get by. It's fine. We can do it. But the thing was, at one point, we were about halfway down this road and something happened. And that was a sports car. I think it was a Camaro or a Charger or something. I don't know. But he came blaring down this road well over 100 kilometers per hour, probably somewhere around 80 miles per hour. And I didn't hear him until he was literally right beside us. Like, that's how fast he was going.
Wow.
And it was so fucking loud. It was so fucking loud. I involuntarily screamed and almost fell off my bike. I had to stop. I was panting. My heart was racing. It scared the fucking shit out of me. Like, I thought, like, for a split second, I was like, holy fuck, I'm dead. Like, I thought, like, a car was right behind me and about to just destroy me. My wife screamed. I didn't hear her. This is how loud that thing, that car was. I did not hear her. She like screamed profanities after the fact. We talked about it. I was like, I didn't hear you scream. She's like, I didn't hear you scream. It was so fucking loud. We were just like, holy fuck. Absolutely terrifying. And the point why I wanted to bring this up is not that I wanted to share the fact that I had many thoughts about if we see this guy up the road, I'm literally going to smash his windows with my bike lock. Like, I was literally thinking that. I was like, this fucking asshole needs to learn his fucking lesson. I'll beat the fucking shit out of him. See, last week we talked about not getting all raged up. It happened again. Thankfully, I didn't have the chance to do that. The point I wanted to bring up at this is that we need to have safe infrastructure, mm-hmm. right? Not because mm-hmm. of people like me who will ride places like this, not in those situations. That shouldn't be happening. But even if it was just regular people driving at 50 or 60 kilometers an hour, I'll be fine. Most people will not be fine there. That's for at most 10% of the population would be willing to ride there when drivers are going the proper speed.
Mm-hmm.
That's not good enough. And the North Shore is a great example of a place that has tried to put in some infrastructure, but it is nowhere near to be good enough. At most, you're going to get 10% of the population willing to ride there. And it's just, it's not good enough. So that's what I wanted to say, was that we need better infrastructure everywhere so people feel safe.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not that guy was going to hit us, he was in control of his car. Things could have happened. They didn't.
Yeah.
But it was a moment that was scary enough for me that it put me off. And I don't want to ride there again.
Yeah.
I'm not going to ride there again. Mm-hmm. I'm going to find different ways to get around because that was so unpleasant. I never want to experience that again. I don't want to put myself in that situation again.
Yeah. I think what you're highlighting here, it's not just about the built infrastructure, because even if you had barriers there, even if you had concrete barriers, cars flying by like that is scary. Cars breaking the speed limit like that is scary. And I want to highlight, there's this one bridge in Calgary that the roads department at one point was planning to widen significantly during that time, and I'll share my screen here so that people can see this. They were going to widen this significantly, and when this was under construction. So this is over the Elbow River here. You've got downtown over here and Inglewood over here, which is a really nice community. But they were going to put huge wide lanes, like what you would see on a main highway, like the QE2, Highway 1, that sort of thing. That's where you'd see lanes as wide as what they wanted to do. And then they were also going to have wide what do you call them, shoulders on the side of this bridge. And when the planning department, when the city planners went to the roads department and said, hey, why are you planning to have these huge wide margins on the side here and have this big wide road? Like, this is a community street. This is a main street that it leads into here. That's one lane of traffic with a parking lane. And they said, well, it's for safety. It's for safety. What if a car, you know, what if a car goes off the edge or right? They need that space to recover. But then we put pedestrians and cyclists in that recovery space, in that recovery zone, in that buffer zone. There was a video I saw on TikTok, and I wish I had it lined up here. But they were talking about that buffer zone and why we put soft, squishy humans in that buffer zone. When we build our infrastructure, we build our posts with these shearing pins so that it comes off when a car hits it. The way that we build our curbs, it's so that it's at a specific angle so that cars can hit it at speed, but it won't damage the car, right? It'll just kind of like stop the car-ish, right? Like, these are the things that we're thinking about. We're thinking more about paint jobs and less about humans. And this is a great example of that. And a great example of why it's not just important to have protected bike lanes, but it's also important to have separated bike lanes, like completely separated, and have streets that are just for bikes and just for pedestrians. Because even if you have like some protection, that doesn't necessarily make it a safe, comfortable place to ride where you'd want your grandma or your child riding, right?
Alex, we don't want people worrying about deadly fixed objects when they're driving down the street.
Oh my God.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's like when you see pictures of, I don't know if it's Korea or somewhere, but they've basically used the middle of the highway and built a bike lane, a covered bike lane right down the middle of a, you know, 3-lane highway on each side. It's like, yeah, it may be safe. It might be. I don't know if it is, but that's not comfortable. It's definitely not comfortable. It's going to be loud and stinky and just unpleasant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know Austin, one of our patrons, one of our main listeners and commenters, Austin's told me about him riding on the side of the highway and some specific spots where he's like, I would never do that again. But in some locations, like if you're riding somewhere, that's how you're getting around. I've gone for walks along the side of a highway because, well, that's how I needed to get to where I was going. So we really need to think about that. There's something else that I'm going to bring up that's kind of related to this when we get to Nick's story later in the episode. But for now, I'd like to move things on to Ethan with some good news.
Well, folks, we're going to switch the topic from our lovely topic of cycling and move on over to the wonderful topic of zoning. So there's this wonderful region. I'd said wonderful like 15 times, but it doesn't matter. There's this region of the U.S. called the Sun Belt that is known quite well for its single family housing. And there's one specific state there called Arizona that's known for lack of a better term, having a lot of single family housing, which, you know, isn't a very efficient way to use land or anything along those lines. And this is a state that's been growing quite exponentially when it comes to its population. You know, people like warm weather and they want to move there. But they've had a housing crisis, and it's exacerbated, especially in places where people want to move to. So in order to meet some of this demand, the state has actually recently just passed a law signed by Governor, I believe it's Governor Katie Hobbs, but she signed into law the Casita Bill. And Casita is just one of those names. It's just a nickname in the Southwest for essentially an accessory dwelling unit, a mother-in-law's house, anything like that. And what this Casita Bill does is it legalizes a lot more. It basically frees up a lot more, you know, areas for ADUs to be built. It's not for every single place in the state, but it is quite sweeping for a lot of the major areas in the state, Phoenix and Tucson mostly. And it is quite exciting to see this because if you don't know, I mean, ADUs are amazing for actually increasing density without increasing the...
Did we lose him?
We might have lost Ethan. So, well, yeah, Ethan is totally gone.
He's gone.
He's gone.
He's quit the podcast.
He's gone. Yeah.
Could maybe you maybe the that's how BP Oil called them. They're like, hey, we got money for you right now. And he's like, okay, I'm out. See ya.
I'm out.
I'm gone.
He got the text and the caller ID said BP. And he's like, all right, I know what this is. Peace out. Knocked off the show. I'm going to continue the conversation about zoning, not particularly about Arizona's zoning changes, though this is fantastic to see those changes. Calgary is working on similar changes right now, actually. I think they're in a meeting to kind of have a conversation about helping promote ADUs, which is these accessory dwelling units. But Halifax is actually also working on some zoning changes. I think almost every major city has been doing this, which is great to see. But yeah, Halifax has been working on this, and I think I don't know exactly how their process differs from what's happened in Calgary, and I only heard about this happening just today, but I guess they are doing a lot to increase the height as well as the number of dwelling units allowed per property. So I kind of want to lead into this discussion, and if Ethan is able to join us again, which it appears that he is loading back up right now, we'll continue the conversation on rezoning here. Nick, well, Ethan figures this out. We heard a clap, which Ethan's famous clap. He's back, folks.
Let's go, folks. We are so back. We've never been more back than we are now.
We're so backer than we're ever back before.
We're the backest. We're actually the backest.
We're without a doubt back.
Yeah, stay tuned for our sequel podcast, Radio Free Backism. So Ethan, I kind of went ahead and talked a little bit about the Halifax rezoning. If you want to continue discussing the Arizona rezoning bills, and then we can have a broad conversation about rezoning in general. So I'll pass that back to you.
I don't know where I actually got cut off there, but I was kind of just mentioning that it's just mostly for ADUs, and it's mostly in ADUs in larger cities. There are some stipulations about smaller cities kind of weaseling their way out of this one. But regardless, it is still very helpful that there is, you know, more housing being able to be built and a more diverse selection of housing that's able to be built rather than just forcing everything to be, single family zoning or single family housing in R1 zoning, which is the lowest density zoning that you can have. Because, yeah, you can build more dense housing in low density. Like, it doesn't all have to be single family detached. You can do duplexes, triplexes, other constructions. And I mean, it is good to see that ADUs, even though they are the smallest kind of change, are being legalized for more areas.
Yeah, ADUs really, they're kind of this like sneaky density. You don't really notice it. Honestly, like, we legalized ADUs across the city, I think almost 10 years ago in Calgary. And it's like, you don't notice it. You don't notice the change really, really at all. It's a pretty small difference, but it is an important start. Nick, I want to hear your thoughts on rezoning, because Vancouver's done some rezoning stuff, maybe too little too late, I don't know.
Yeah, but I know not too long ago we did the upzoning similar to what just happened in Calgary with our CG, which is really nice. But ADUs are something that are very, very popular here in Vancouver. You'll see them being built all the time. I was looking at one today, actually. An entire house got demolished, and right behind that on the opposite block in the alleyway, I could see one being built, and I went around to check it out because I find them really interesting. I love ADUs. I find them, they're cute. I love that some people call them grandma suites. And some that I've seen are just beautiful. Like, they look like little beautiful homes. I almost actually moved into one. I almost rented one a few years ago before I moved into this building, but it was a bit small for us. But yeah, I think rezoning has to happen everywhere. We've talked about before, and that we're seeing it happen in many, many places across the continent is a good sign. And I think ADUs are the first thing people are ready to get on board with, because it's really simple and straightforward. And especially homeowners, they see the upsides from their own personal motivations, that ground up motivation to say, hey, this is something that I can add to my property to add value and add some income every month, basically. So that's a real good bonus. But I don't know what else to say about ADUs other than, yeah, they're awesome.
Yeah, they're a great step forward, especially when it comes to just increasing density in neighborhoods.
Yeah, like, but calling them sneaky density, I like that.
Yeah.
And gentle really, density, no.
I mean, it really is the first step in added density. I'm going to try and find one that I like to show you guys. I actually grew up in a house with an ADU, and it was fine. We had renters in there. At one point, my stepsister moved into that one. So let me show you guys this one. Let's see.
I also love all the different names that they have, like, everywhere, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a fun little cultural thing about, like, housing that honestly just kind of, like, because, like, everywhere kind of just calls single-family homes, but no one's got a real, like, definitive name for ADUs.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's kind of different. You get to switch it up a little bit. So, Nick's got one here.
Yeah, so here you can see what it looked like before, you know, garage. Oh, there's this lovely tree they cut down. I didn't realize that. That's unfortunate. Yeah, and then that's what it looks like now. It's just this nice, it looks like a split level house almost. It's one that I've seen a few times.
That's cute.
It looks really nice.
Yeah. That's cute. That is super cute. Here, I will share this one. Ba-bum-bum. Here it is. This is one not too far from me, but it's this, like, look, it's just this little, like, tiny little thing. But this is what it looked like before, is just somebody's backyard, and then they decided to change it. So
they
let
just
me see.
Decided to torch the neighborhood character. I can't believe it.
Well, exactly. I know. It is awful. They've since gone to prison for turning
Thank
it
God.
You know, for doing something so awful, like providing housing where once was basically just grass. Yeah, and like it fits in pretty well. Like, if you didn't know better, you'd think, oh, well, that's just an extra small home on this little street, you know? And I think it's a great, great thing that's been done. But yeah, like it's really, really minor, and it is such a drop in the bucket, but it's also, it's a broad market solution. That allows other people to make small bets. There are other developments in Calgary. There's one called Curry Barracks, which we've talked about before, I'm pretty sure. Midtown, which I know I've talked about on here. But these are big bets. These are really big bets. But opening up the market in this way for individuals to participate in this providing of housing, as well as potentially collecting some rental income, can work if you've got kids or a parent that needs to move closer and maybe needs a little bit more care, or it's just nice to spend, you know, a little bit closeness, a little bit more time with some family who might appreciate that.
Yeah, it's definitely a great thing for our cities, and the fact that it hasn't been legalized for pretty much everywhere is kind of insane.
Yeah. Yeah, it's frustrating, and I'm glad Arizona's making that step towards that. This has gone into effect.
Yeah, this was signed by the governor, I believe, yesterday. So I think it's immediately, like, in effect. But yeah, I mean, obviously these zoning changes do take some time, especially these more broad-faced ones. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, being able to, you know, this pretty much covers the whole Phoenix metro area and the whole Tucson metro area, so we should be seeing more housing, at least the ability to build more housing in these neighborhoods out there. So, yeah, and there's a lot of single family homes with large yards to start with out there. So,
yeah, that's great. All right. Well, let's move on to Nick's story here. I think we'll have a lot of conversation to do around this one. Nick, if you want to take that away.
Yeah, this is coming from Edmonton. So the War on Cars finally released their content from the Winter Cycling Congress in Edmonton that took place back in February. They talk about the state of cycling in urbanism in Edmonton, the juxtaposition between Edmonton's identity around oil, being this oil city, in the up and coming cycling paradise that it might become with so much investment that's been happening. And they talked to all sorts of people, just people who live there, people who are from far and wide who came to the Winter Cycling Congress to just talk about their experiences. But most interestingly, they actually talked to the former mayor, Don Iveson of Edmonton, and their conversation was at the end of this show. This was probably one of the longest podcasts they've released in a very long time. I think it was almost an hour and 40 minutes or something like that. But yeah, the last 45 minutes or so was the live conversation that they had at the Winter Cycling Congress back in February with Don Iveson. And it was a very, very good conversation. And Don had some really good insight about kind of how long it takes to change things, but how you can slowly move these ships in the directions you want to move them if you keep working at it. And it was really, really enjoyable. I absolutely loved it. And this is a coming back to the Jekyll and Hyde thing I was talking about, because that's the positive stuff we're seeing, right? It's really good to see in that Edmonton is investing over $100 million, I think, in their cycling infrastructure, which is huge. It's incredible. And the turn here is for me to complain again about how here in Vancouver, that's not happening. We've been spending money to get rid of bike lanes, to go backwards, and to see another city, one that we traditionally would associate with big trucks and SUVs and stuff like that, is moving in the right direction. And it's really disheartening. And the good thing I can get out of that is that if the current government here in Vancouver wasn't doing this stuff, I might not be here today talking with you guys on this podcast, because it was the decision with the Broadway to eliminate bike lanes from the plan that kind of kickstarted me into the more advocacy type route. So there's good things to have. But the point why I wanted to really bring this up is that you can't be complacent. You have to keep working. Things aren't a foregone conclusion. You can have wins and be moving in the right direction. Things can change and somebody can mess that up. So you got to stay steadfast and keep working at it. So another point to that is, if you haven't listened to the bonus episode, I talked to Lucy Maloney from Visions Air Vancouver, Love the Lane, and other advocacy groups. She's fantastic, but she had some great insight about how to actually deal with that. And when you're in these positions, when you're dealing with people who are against your best interest and they're against what you're wanting to do in your city, is finding ways to work with them and to collaborate with them and compromise to get some kind of solution so that you're not just yelling into the void and not getting anything done, which I think was really important. Anyway, what do you guys, any comments about this?
Ethan, you got thoughts?
I mean, it's good seeing that, you know, cities, especially ones that aren't traditionally known for cycling, not only for, you know, big oil money, but also just because it's freezing cold there and, you know, wintertime, invest in their actual cycling infrastructure. And it really just, like, I love how all the North American cities that have really good cycling infrastructure and have really good cycling numbers always have, like, the worst weather. Because we also have we have Minneapolis in the U.S. That's one of the premier cycling cities. But God, is winter awful there. And it's good seeing the Winter Cycling Congress kind of come out and, you know, actually, you know, highlight that, hey, you can cycle year round. But yeah, I mean, there's no such thing as a guaranteed win. I mean, a win can happen, but then you can lose it. It happens in cities all the time. It's not just Vancouver. You have places like Portland as well, too. Or especially recently with transit, Houston getting rid of some of their BRT services. It's not a secured win. Nothing is ever a secured win. And you actually have to actively keep supporting the good transit and good cycling infrastructure that we have in order to keep a hold on to it. You have to maintain the systems that you have.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's huge, is that continued effort. One thing from this podcast that I wanted to highlight, I listened to this one, yesterday, today, and it included a conversation that Don Iveson, or not that Don Iveson, that was it Doug? Who was it that went on the radio? Yeah. It was Doug. So Doug from the War on Cars went on the radio, was chatting with these hosts, and as they're wrapping up the conversation, the one host says, he's like, or the first host, the woman says, I actually, she's like, yeah, I'm a fan of bike lanes because it gets them out of my way. It's safer for them. It's safer for me. You know, like, give them their own space, right?
Give cyclists like, in the bike. Yeah, keep them in the bike lanes.
She's like, I don't do that. So yeah, give them bike lanes. But then the male host, he says, I just wish it didn't cost so much money. And Doug fortunately says, wait till you hear about highways. And we cannot stress this enough. The importance of realizing how much all of this other infrastructure costs. You know, when we talk about transit projects, we always, the ballooning costs of the Green Line LRT, what are we going to do about this? Are you sure you want this to stand? That's taxpayers' money. But when a new road is being built, it's just like, think of the economic activity. You know, like we sell it as this absolutely definitely 100% only good thing.
Five years late, $1 billion over budget, but we are relieving traffic forever with the ultimate I-4 project.
Right. Like, oh, wow, we magically solved this issue. But let me show you some data here from the city of Calgary. I'm working on a video for Unsprawling where we address this. So this is the cost of transportation per kilometer traveled by each transportation option. So here on the far right, you have car, you have cost to society, and you have personal costs. Society, pollution, that costs society 16 cents per kilometer traveled. Then maintenance and road work, that's just for the infrastructure, okay? That's 14 cents per kilometer traveled. Then society infrastructure, congestion, collisions, maintain and operate the vehicle, the carbon and fuel tax, which people complain so much about the carbon tax and the fuel tax and stuff. That is 2 cents per kilometers traveled compared to everything else, and it works out to being about $1.25 Canadian per kilometer traveled by car in the city of Calgary. Then you have transit, and it works out to 67 cents per kilometer traveled in the city of Calgary. Cycling is 1 cent per kilometer traveled, and walking is negative 25 cents because you have additional value given back to society through your own personal health, as well as by reducing the costs on the healthcare system. This is huge. Cars are by far the most expensive way to travel. I'm going to share another little bit of data here that was shared with me today, again, for this video I'm working on. So this comes from Mean Median Mode Choice, which I'm not too familiar with, but they had some interesting information here. And so this is daily users of major downtown access routes getting into downtown Calgary. So you've got Louise, Centre Street Upper, Reconciliation, Flyovers, 9th Ave, McLeod Trail, all of these things. And it shows on this graph how many people get into these areas by number of cars. And so the busiest route is the 5th Ave flyover. No surprise there to any Calgarians, but it's about 37,000 cars using that route daily. Then we have then they say, okay, well, let's look at the daily users of major downtown access routes. Let's look at buses as well, not just cars. Let's look at buses. And it's really, really hard to see on this graph, but you can see in a few spots here, you can see that there's this green strip here. So there's tons and tons of cars, just a few buses. But of course, we want to talk about people, not vehicles. So then they do this analysis and all this data. This is back in 2020 that they posted this, but then they expand these things. So that little sliver has now turned into over nearly 25,000 people, about 20,000 people, let's say, transported via one route into downtown on the upper deck of the Centre Street Bridge. 20,000 people transported into downtown. That's the same, nearly the same as the number of people transported by cars, okay? But it looked like a little sliver. Now let's add in the LRT, and suddenly you have these huge green bars of people transported into downtown Calgary by the LRT. From the northwest leg of the LRT alone, you have 45,000 people transported into downtown. That's more than any of the road access routes. And then you also have the South LRT at nearly 50,000 people. Like, these guys, investing in transit and active transportation is so much more financially prudent and efficient than all of these other things. So when people bring up the cost of cycling infrastructure, the cost of transit infrastructure, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
The cost of cycling infrastructure is the funniest thing ever,
too. Pennies. It's pennies, right, Ethan?
No, seriously. Like, but cycling infrastructure, you can tell people, it costs nothing. All you're doing is maintaining the existing road. When you rebuild a road over time, you're going to have to do that anyways. That's money you were going to spend regardless.
Yeah.
But if you add in the extra minuscule cost to put in a tiny little concrete barrier and some green paint down, congratulations. You just saved your city a shitload of money.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we need to be talking about these things as cost-saving measures, because we cannot keep doing this. This is expensive. People wonder why their taxes go up every year. It's not because the city's greedy. It's not because the city's doing more things magically. It's because the infrastructure has gotten more and more and more expensive to maintain. And we really need to start thinking about that. I'm going to share one more thing. I've really gone off here. Nick, you have a thought?
No, are you going to share the Strong Towns thing?
No, okay. I was going to share a cute image first, but
you shared something in our chat on Patreon from the Strong Towns conference that happened just recently, mm-hmm. and it was about the total annualized cost of cars and how parking takes up an insane amount of that whole chart. It is absolutely, it's almost off the charts. You know, they stretched the chart out so they could include parking, because it is by far the tallest bar on that chart. It's just insane how much space and money we spend for people to park. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's insane. Every time I'm riding down the street on my bike, I'm like, God, this road is huge. But, you know, half of it just meant for storing people's private property.
Yeah. Yeah. It is absolutely wild.
You can't forget about the tax revenue loss, too, as well. Just the full on economic loss of parking is insane.
Yeah, because it is an opportunity cost as well to be considered. But going back to Edmonton, I want to show people some of the work that Edmonton has done, and they really have done a fantastic job at some of their new streetscaping. This is right along the Valley Line LRT, their new LRT line that's all pretty and shiny that Austin and I rode the other week. They've done some really, really great work on the streetscaping, and hopefully it starts attracting some private investment on these. But they're even doing these as shared streets. I tried to zoom in on that sign here. Let me see if I can go back. They're even doing these as shared streets, which promote that's the best traffic calming, is just being like, everybody's here and you're gonna slow down. You are not a priority. Cars are guests here, and I think that's fantastic. They're doing
those
great
brick
work.
Pavers, they do look a little bit better for riding on with a bike than more traditional bricks, honestly, like just from the design. But they're still gonna slow down a car, because I mean, it's gonna create that road noise that, you know, slows down vehicles. And I mean, what is that, a in U.S. American numbers, 15 miles an hour, basically?
Yeah, a 20-kilometer maximum, I think, is 15-ish.
Yeah, so that's – actually, it might even be lower than that. But, that's slow.
Yeah. I think those signs, they need to change them, though. We need to just follow Dutch. It needs to say, cars are guests. Because, you know, you see those signs on the side of the road that said, share the road, and it shows a bicycle next to a car, which the sign is supposed to mean, hey, drivers – share the road, because there's bicyclists here, but they think it means move the fuck over. You're supposed to share the road.
You're hogging the road,
you cyclist.
Yeah.
We need to make it more clear to let it know, let people know what it actually means. Not be like, hey, everybody play together. It's like, no, if you're in a car, slow the fuck down. there's other people here who are vulnerable.
Yeah.
Make way for them. It's not like a sign does anything. It's really all about the road design itself. But
true.
That's true. That's true. But I think the communication that Nick is bringing up is kind of an important part.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. You know? I'm just saying that drivers don't really care about signs.
Oh, yeah. No. No. There was one. There was one. Somebody, like a drunk driver, drove into somebody's home in Calgary the other week. And the counselor went out and put down these two concrete barriers there, and they posted a speed limit sign there, and they're like, yeah, now we solved the problem. And it's like, yes, drunk drivers famously stopped by speed limit signs. Oh, also, that now you have two concrete barriers in front of your house.
Oh, my God. It's like, okay, I got a side story here about concrete barriers, because... So my parents, they just moved recently, but they used to live on Lake Erie in Ontario, close to Chatham, Ontario, down south there. Beautiful property, but they lived right along Talbot Trail, which is just a two-lane highway type of thing, right? And it's a long road that just hugs Lake Erie all the way down to Leamington, I think. But there's a lot of erosion, just natural erosion from the lake, the waves lapping up, and a lot of it has washed into the lake, this part, this section. So they've closed off that section of this trail, and several concessions before that, there's plenty of signs that say road closed ahead, make a detour. On my mom's quote unquote block, like these are country blocks, right? Is where that it ends. So my parents always have to go out the north way or the east way, I suppose, to get out. But time and time again, you can sit there and watch people come by. And my stepdad would be like, oh, that guy's turning around. Because he's like, I don't know who that person is. They're not my neighbor. And then sure enough, 2 minutes later, they come back. But the thing is, people will speed down this road at night. And several times, people have sped directly into this barrier that has been put up. Just like right into it. Completely ignoring signs. And anyway, I don't know where I was going with this. Signs stop car, or sorry, barriers stop cars. They do the job.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess it'd be better than them going into the lake off the cliff.
Always, I don't know. I'm always amazed when DOTs put up these like confusing ass signs for the road. Like we were talking about it with like the managed lanes last week. I'm always amazed because it just never occurs in these planners' heads that it's like, have you ever read a road sign with that much detail? Or do you understand like the average American when driving? They are not looking to read all the road signs. They are looking for a Cadillac Escalade that is going to pull out going 90 miles an hour and cut them off over 3 lanes and then slam on their brakes. That's what they're looking for, because that's what happens when you design every road like a highway.
Yeah.
And when you decide to put up signs that have all the wording in the world on it, people aren't going to read it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's why road design is so important, right? Like, that's the level we need to start at. And we really need to start by just assuming everybody is stupid. You know, like, that's the bare minimum. I mean, everybody who has been behind the wheel of a car has thought, boy, that person's dumb, and gone home and wondered about the state of the world. But if, you know, if we're all doing that, maybe we can all agree that we need to do something about it. Like, we need to think differently about the way that we're planning this. So those are my thoughts on that. Anything else you guys are thinking?
Yeah, just wanted to add, so back to the conversation that Don had with the War on Cars, the live show in Edmonton. Jen in the live chat says, she liked Don mentioning motorists being equestrians looking down on pedestrians. That's kind of a way, he kind of likened it to the days gone by. And also, design for the worst weather and have great infrastructure all year round. Yeah, if you can design your infrastructure to be good enough for the winter, it's going to be good enough for the whole year. And that's what we need to aim to do. Someplace it's not going to happen. It's not happening here in Vancouver, because we get like one crazy day a year and they're just like, we can't. Everything's just going to shut. Let's all shut down for a day. It's fine. Let it melt.
So that's a big thing too. That, like, I was having a conversation with somebody yesterday, and they were asking me about living car free, and they're from Arizona, and they currently live in Mexico, and they're like, So, you know, they're like, I can't imagine, you know, what do you do in the winter? And I'm like, well, you know, you bundle up and whatever, right? I have studs on my bike if I'm going to ride my bike. But they said, yeah, but like, wouldn't you rather have a car? I'm like, listen, getting around when it's 40 below sucks, regardless of how you're getting around. It sucks. And fortunately, that's not every day in the winter. I love the people who show up to council hearings and things like that and say, we're a winter city. We get 9 months of winter. And I'm like, we do not get 9 months of winter. No, we do not. You know, like this view that somehow it's impossible because of the weather is ridiculous. We have pretty decent weather here, and we can manage it it pretty well.
There's always excuses.
Yeah. There's always excuses.
You can solve for any excuse and be like, you can get them to agree with that. There's another one. There's always another one.
There's the lovely Sunbelt excuse of, oh, it's too hot in the summertime.
Yeah. Like, just, I was on Reddit the other day and somebody had posted in Suburban Hell about how they had to drive 7 minutes to their neighbor's house. And they showed like the subdivision and you had to go all the way out to the main road and back around to get to their neighbor's house. And then they shared a picture of the street view. Why do you think they couldn't drive there? There was a modal filter. Yeah. And it was like, you can fucking walk or take your bike. And then someone said, what if you're 87 years old? And you're like, oh my God, getting in a wheelchair. Holy shit. And if you absolutely have to, you'll drive the 7 minutes. But that's the point.
One, yeah. And Jen says something in the live chat here that I think is really insightful. She says, big picture is design roads for the least competent, pedestrian spaces for the least able, and bike infrastructure for the worst weather, and all modes get the best designs. I think that's I think that sums it up.
We should be doing that statement
really well. We are what are we doing, guys? I like, our shows are getting shorter and shorter and shorter here. But we're gonna get into the,
we're just really snappy with our stories. That's
we are
all.
we're too efficient of news tellers.
When it's just the three of us, we can just run through our stories like there's no tomorrow.
I always,
it's
got more. I got backup
this
stories.
This is why everybody needs to join the live chat, so that way we can have wonderful discussions like we do with these wonderfully insightful comments from Jen Hall.
And that's why you should sign up on the Patreon, because then you'll get to watch the show live on Wednesday nights.
What else do you have better to do on a Wednesday? I mean, like,
literally,
it's Wednesday.
It's a Wednesday. Come on. All right. We are going to go into some listener mail, though. I think we can do that. We got some interesting insights, people talking about their own experiences overpaying for transit. We went off, and I want to publicly apologize to all the nice Montreal bus drivers out there. I did really enjoy my time in Montreal. I went off a little bit about Montreal, and I just want to apologize. There are some wonderful people out there. I did honestly enjoy my time. I was just a little bit frustrated by the payment system, which is changing. So we can move on from that, and I hope
they'll never let you move on.
I hope the metropolitan region of Montreal will accept my sincerest apologies. Nick or Ethan, you can rock, paper, scissors. I don't know.
First I want to say, if you want to send us a message, of course, go to YouTube, just leave a comment or email us at radiofreeurbanism@gmail.com. But if you do, just please keep it brief. We've got many emails and they've been like really long. We really appreciate it. Like, really appreciate it. But like, we can't read them all on the podcast. They're so long.
We're trying. We do try, but it is a lot to go to
our
go through and
have
try
all been
and
rotted by TikTok and Instagram reels and YouTube shorts. We need you to keep it concise, okay? We appreciate the comments. We love them. We cannot read three pages of email.
It's true. We really do appreciate it.
We do. Like it we just need concise, you know, responses.
Speaking of concise questions, we've got one here from Jen Hall. And she says, a lot of conflict between car drivers and micromobility riders comes from lack of education on who has writes to what, where, and when on our streets. Any ideas about how to improve education for both sides? Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I'd come from the big picture point and saying we need to segregate people, and not in the way that they used to do it. We need to disentangle like they do in the Netherlands. We need, like Alex said earlier in the show, separate roads for cyclists and separate roads for cars. And of course, we're going to cross paths from time to time. And in those moments, it's just everybody should have like basically the same rules. It's like if you're coming up to a stop sign, who's there first, right? It should be the same type of education that should come for both sides of this. And on top of that, like we talked about, I don't know if it was last episode or before, about licensing when it comes to PEVs and things like that and micromobility devices, we need some more education in that direction when people aren't driving as much and not getting that training in driving school.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree. I hope no one takes the beginning of your clip there out of context, but
what did I say?
No, it's definitely... You said we need segregation, so...
oh, God.
You heard it here first, folks.
That's right. Nick Laporte is done for. Anyways, but no, I do agree. I do think that there does need to be education both on both sides, but I think if we really want to fix the issue... obviously, people are going to slack off when, you know, it comes to educating anyone. But if we really want to fix the issue, we have to go to the source. And that is just road design in the U.S. is not ideal. And it is specifically car oriented and treats every other road user like they're nothing.
I actually like that education through design. It's really simple. But I think... having these conversations with people as their students, you know, the way that we do with cars, right? Like we educate people on how to navigate the city by car. We need to do the same by transit and by bike, and make it possible to do that as well. I was just having a conversation with somebody yesterday, and they were telling me how they've been riding their bike on this busy road, and somebody said to them, oh, well, just go one block over, and it's like perfect for cyclists. And so having that education and that wayfinding, you know, like Ethan's talking about by design, I think is huge for us. Yeah. Any other thoughts?
No.
No.
Yeah. No. Think that's...
It's a lot like, you know, you teach kids how to cross the street.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Look both ways. It comes a lot of that, but... we need to have organizations that do this. Like we have here Hub Cycling in Vancouver. They do bike days at schools a lot to educate children. But I think that should come from the government. Like this should be a thing that's just in schools. Like it could be part of a PE class or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, it's just part of the programming.
It really just has to be. It has to be normalized in pretty much every way that we can.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess, are we going to wrap it up?
I've got another one. I always got one on deck.
You got things? Go got ahead, something. Nick.
Yeah, this one is something I came across on Instagram from the Biking Lawyer. And if you don't follow the Biking Lawyer, please go check them out because they always have great stuff. I really like it. Maybe we'll have them on the show for a bonus episode sometime. Anyway, this is from the Toronto Star. How a Toronto police officer's, a police complaint, it's office, what? How a Toronto police complaints officer belittled a criticism about bike lanes and why advocates say it's a problem. I don't know why I had such a hard time reading that. Anyway, let me read this. And let me just say before I read this, it's funny and it's slightly brilliant, but also it's totally inappropriate. So anyway, here's some excerpts. The police can park where they need to. If they wanted to park upside down, inside out, or on top of a building, that would be acceptable. The 32-year-old cyclist stared at an email in disbelief. She wondered if the Toronto Police Unit complaint coordinator who sent it to her had been hacked or was just having a bad day. it's a pretty rude response. But they also went on to say, thankfully, our police cars are visible to the naked eye. So unless someone is experimenting with cycling with his eyes shut or a giant police emblazoned SUVs won't infringe on any cyclist's safety. Next time you see a police officer parked on or near the Sherbourne bike lanes, please do what I do. Thank him or her for his service, wrote the officer for the 51 Division, whose name the Star is withholding at the request of the cyclist. It's just so...
Oh my God.
This, somebody wrote into the police to say, hey, your bike, or sorry, not your bike, your the police cars have been parking in this bike lane repeatedly. And that's the response they got back from the police service in Toronto, which is obviously very rude. Kind of funny, I get it, but also it, inappropriate.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, to say that it's there are absolutely concrete reasons why a police officer should be there or could use that is absolutely fine. Stopping on your laptop, going to grab a coffee, non-emergency situations, why do you have to be in the bike lane? There's other places to park. You're forcing a cyclist to go into the road, and that's not safe. It's simply not safe.
Yeah.
They were dismissing this as a safety concern, and that's the biggest problem, is that it is. You're forced to change your path, having to look over your shoulder, hope that a car is not speeding or someone's going to squeeze you off the road. Because we've seen a lot of this out of New York City. The New York City micromobility subreddit, it's a fucking goldmine for this. Holy shit, the videos that get posted of cars parked in the bike lanes. There was one this week. Literally, the entire separated bike lane was filled. There was a truck at the end of it, at the end of the block, unloading stuff in a separated bike lane, like with full concrete jersey barriers. And then behind it, cars followed it. So it was just full of cars. But this is different. This is probably a bike stripe, I imagine, in Toronto. But yeah, it's a real problem. And
yeah.
We need to have separated infrastructure where, yes, emergency services can use it in an emergency, right? Like, for example, there was this video I posted about this critical mass thing that happened on last Friday at City Hall. There was a die-in on the street, on one of the main streets on 12th Avenue. And an ambulance came by twice because it's pretty close to the hospital, VGH. And what happened? There's tons of traffic blocked up. And this was not because of us. It was on the other side that was blocked up because of us. We moved out of the way in 2 seconds, and the ambulance goes right on through long before they even got to us, both times, right?
Yeah.
And that's a great example of how quality bike infrastructure can be used for emergency services when they need it. But when they don't need it, come on. Like, come on. Like, you're just being lazy. You're being lazy.
Yeah.
Jen also brought up a great, app. Bike Lane Uprising is not that's only... Good. Yeah, it's an app that you can use to report pretty much, you know, any bike lane obstructions like that. And yeah, I use it myself. I mean, I don't ride in that many bike lanes. Unfortunately, I don't have too many out here. But I mean, if it does happen, I'm going to report it. So,
yeah, that's awesome. I also I want to highlight something that Jen said before as well, kind of going back to the education aspect. Two things. She asked about education because design takes a long time and a lot of money, and education we can get started with now. I also want to mention, she said, we could do a PSA like the House Hippo ad, which, Ethan, do you know about
this
ad?
Yes, I know about the House Hippo ad. You know about the ad? Yes.
Okay. I am going to share it. I am going to share it because I think it is important for our viewers to understand.
It's nighttime in a kitchen just like yours. All is quiet. Or is it? The North American House Hippo is found throughout Canada and the eastern United States. House hippos are very timid creatures and are rarely seen. But they will defend their territory if provoked. They come out at night to search for food, water, and materials for their nests. The favorite foods of the house hippo are chips, raisins, and the crumbs from peanut butter on toast. They build their nests in bedroom closets, using lost mittens, dryer lint, and bits of string. The nests have to be very soft and warm. House hippos sleep about 16 hours a day.
That looked really real, but you knew it couldn't be true, didn't you? That's why it's good to think about what you're watching on TV and ask questions, kind of like you just did. A message from Concerned Children's Advertisers.
All right. You're welcome, everybody. So if somebody can make us a PSA for cycling that is somehow, you know, gets the tone of this ad, I'd thoroughly appreciate that. I will buy you food at Around the Bend if you do that. So, and that's a Radio Free Urbanism guarantee right there. Yeah.
This is the first Radio Free Urbanism guarantee that has been made so far.
So it's a big deal. It's a big deal. Because we're creating a whole new thing for it. But yeah, thanks. This was fun. Any final thoughts as we wrap her up?
I have a little thing.
Yeah, give us a little thing.
Okay, before we close off the show, I released my most recent reel, which is about die-ins. I don't know if you guys saw it or not, but it's about die-ins, which have been around for a long time for different types of political purposes to protest where people lie in the street. And it was highlighting the one that happened here in Vancouver, protesting the fact that our city government time after time keeps rolling back on cycling infrastructure in Vancouver. Anyway, there was a lot of comments and there's still lots of comments rolling. I don't even look at them anymore. It's one that's going to be controversial. So what do you think half of the comments are saying? Anybody want to guess? Any guesses?
I'm going to go on my evil assumption here of the internet that they're saying that the driver should drive right through you guys.
How could you possibly guess that correctly? What a genius. Yeah, I think a quarter of them are just GIFs of people like driving and like bumping over stuff. And then another quarter is people saying, I think I know how to actually make them dead. So it's just like insane, like the reaction. Yeah. Like there was a lot of positive reactions and curiosities about it, which
is
great.
There's a lot of lovely sociopaths behind the wheel. I hope that makes everybody sleep well tonight.
It just seems insane, like the reaction to drivers. I don't want to say people who drive, drivers, whatever, people online when it comes to driving and taking away space from cars or simply just to say, hey, we need to make our city safer, because that's the point here, is let's kill them. Like it's just mind-blowing. It's wild.
Remember, murder is legalized if you are behind the wheel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. By the way, there was only two people who I remember seeing who were like yelling at us, like against us, flipping us off. Both of them were driving lifted trucks. I was just like,
I'm shocked.
On brand. I was like, holy
I'm
shit.
I'm shocked.
Yeah. Subsidized by the government.
Yes.
Paving roads extra hard just for them. In their big trucks with their tiny peepees. Ethan, final thoughts.
Cycling good. We and I also saw something horrible this week. A Cybertruck for the first time in my life. So,
oh my god.
Yeah, they're uglier in person.
Yeah, oh, I bet.
Oh man, they are. Yeah, they are a moving eyesore. It's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, boy, what happened to art? That's horrible and I feel bad for you. Sending eyewash.
It may not be enough. I may need a lobotomy.
How can you have a frontal lobotomy with a bottle in front of you?
Wait.
Sorry.
I'll process that later. I have no extra thoughts. Nick, where can we find you?
I am at Nick Laporte on YouTube or Nick the Door on other social media platforms. Oh, and Alex.
Go to Ethan.
Oh, Ethan, where can the people find you? So we usually start with you. So I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah, that is true. We do normally start with me. But folks, you can find me at Climate and Transit, or on Twitter, you can find me at Climate Transit. Alex, where can we find you? I'm pointing this way because he's on my screen that way.
Hey, I'm that way on your screen too, so I appreciate it. You can find me at Humane Cities or Unsprawling. I'm doing a lot of stuff there now too as well. Also, thanks for joining us. And with that, we'll let Ethan start our wrap up.
Folks, train good, car bad.
Two wheels good.
And feet first. We'll see you next time.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. For access to early episodes, live shows, and other perks, join us on Patreon at Radio Free Urbanism.